Silent single-file lines, detention for putting a head on a desk, rules for how to dress, how to applaud, how to complete homework. Walk into some of the most acclaimed urban schools today, and you'll find similar recipes of behavior designed to support student achievement. Joanne Golan spent a year doing just that. In her new book called Scripting the Moves, Culture and Control in a No-Excuses Charter School, Dr. Golan describes the good intentions and the unintended consequences of these rigidly controlled schools. Joanne Golan is Assistant Professor of Public Policy and Education at Peabody College, Vanderbilt University. I asked her why she started this project.
Yeah, so I first heard about these no-excuses schools when I heard about a practice they do that's called SLANT. If you know anything about these schools, you would see students, they kind of sit with their hands folded and they're tracking the teacher in the classroom. But this acronym SLANT stands for sit up, lean forward, ask questions, track the speaker, and nod for understanding. And I thought it was actually a clever way to teach middle-class expectations for showing attention. So sociologists talk about schools as having this hidden curriculum. The hidden curriculum are these expectations that aren't made explicit to students, and thus students who don't know them may be at a disadvantage in schools. So I thought SLANT was a way to make explicit these expectations. You know, I'm not a lot when I'm listening to somebody, but no one ever told me that was what you were supposed to do. So that's what first got me interested in these schools. I was interested in whether they were teaching students what sociologists call cultural capital.
And define, just for everybody, what is a no-excuse school?
Yeah, so the term has been used to characterize this group of high-achieving urban charter schools like KIPP, Success Academy, Achievement First, Uncommon Schools, Yes Prep, the list goes on and on. And they share common practices. Among these are typically extended instructional time, so an extended school year, an extended school day, intensive teacher coaching, data-driven instruction. But most controversially and most distinctive is their highly structured disciplinary system.
And you won't find one of these schools in Beverly Hills, will you?
No, these are schools that serve almost exclusively low-income students, Black and Latinx students.
And talk about the disciplinary structure of the schools, because as you said, it's very strict.
It is very strict. So these schools typically have some kind of rewards and consequences system. What they do is they call this practice sweating the small stuff. So a typical urban school might pick its battles. It might suspend students for lighting a match in the hallway. These schools monitor and pick on every little kind of misbehavior. So they'll give infractions to students for things like putting a head on a desk or talking in the hallway or rolling your eyes at a teacher or not following a direction. So the school I was at, on average, students received one infraction every 3 days over the course of the school year.
What school did you monitor and how did you choose it?
Yeah, so for research, I can't actually say, you know, the name of the school, but it was a school that explicitly said they followed a no excuses approach. It was an approach they had copied from other networks like those I had, you know, spoken of. And I chose it because it showed success in raising student test scores. It was considered a good school. So I wanted to look at the model kind of at its best. And it was open to allowing a researcher in to just hang out with them over the course of a year and a half.
And you call, I mean, the name of the book is Scripting the Moves. What is scripting? You call it scripting success.
Yeah, I took this phrase from an interview transcript I read from a principal of another school, and she says what we do is script the moves. We basically tell students and teachers exactly what they're supposed to be doing and how they're supposed to be doing it. And that really resonated with me when I was at this school. So we talked about student behavior. You know, we're very prescriptive about what you can do, what you can say, where you can move. And it's the same thing with teachers. So this struck me, you know, on new teacher orientation, they had, I don't know, a 10-page single-spaced script for, you know, what teachers should say during orientation, where they should be positioned to monitor student behavior. So that was a common theme I saw in the school.
So innovation, not a big deal there?
I would say it can be difficult to innovate. The school said, you know, if I asked them, are there practices, you know, that you think are essential to your school model, practices you would change? And they said, you know, if we're, you know, doing 100 things, we probably need to do 99 to make this model work. They really felt it was a package deal. So there was they were reluctant to modify practices because it was something they had copied. It was something they thought worked. On the other hand, I would say these schools can be, you know, reflective on their practices. And certainly in the past few years, we see some of these networks trying to make changes, particularly to their disciplinary practices.
When you started the project and started doing the research on this school, what did you see that surprised you?
One thing maybe was the stress level of the students. That's something maybe I should have anticipated, but even for students who weren't quote unquote behavioral problems, even students you would think were, you know, the best behaved students, they actually also felt stress from this model because they felt so much pressure to perform and not make a mistake. So I write about one parent who actually kept her fifth grader home for 2 weeks because the girl just couldn't handle the pressure of being set up as a positive example for her classmates.
What about the teachers? How are the teachers reacting to this? You do say in the book that there's quite a bit of turnover in these schools.
That's right. In the school I was at, 50% of the teachers had actually left the previous year. And the school's motto for that year was making that school a better place to work. I characterize teachers into four groups. I call them conformers, adapters, imitators, and rejectors. And I think teachers did vary in response to the school scripts, depending on their own personality, their own classroom management styles, their own background. So we had some teachers who were naturals and they felt very comfortable implementing, you know, strict disciplinary practices. We had others who would adapt these practices. So they would do a silly slant instead of a regular slant, or they would make funny chants to soften the school's disciplinary practices. But then there were teachers who rejected them, and there were teachers who left just after a couple months of being in the school.
I was going to say, of those four, which were the ones most likely to leave?
Definitely the rejectors. So they either disagreed fundamentally with the school's model, the school's ideology, or they didn't feel like they could implement the practices. I had teachers who said, it just does not feel like me. I feel like this is an out-of-body experience.
Did you come out of this year with a negative outlook on these schools?
I would say a critical perspective. At the point I was doing the research, I would say these schools were really held up as exemplars of charter success. They still are, but now people are beginning to recognize some of their drawbacks, some of the cost of these schools. But I hadn't gone into the research with a critical perspective. Like I said at the beginning, I went in interested in a sociological concept of cultural capital, and I really came out seeing the impact of these scripts on students and teachers.
It does seem like there is so much emphasis on discipline that teachers are almost part-time enforcers while they're trying to teach. Is that the way it looked to you?
Absolutely. I felt like a lot of the school day was spent on behavioral management, especially for novice teachers. So teachers whose classrooms weren't in order, then when they had these one-on-one supervisory sessions with their coach, most of that conversation was about discipline. How will you enforce the rules the school wants you to enforce? They were not about teaching or pedagogy.
How many of these schools exist around the country, about?
So KIPP is the largest and first of these networks, and they serve about 100,000 students in 250 or so schools. And then there are maybe a dozen more. Most of them won't call themselves No Excuses schools, but they use very similar practices. They're all these urban charter schools.
When you talk about discipline, are you talking about suspensions, detentions? What are you talking about there?
Yeah, so this varies by network, but those are the most common punishments. So suspension, detention, and also these rewards and consequences. So they can be smaller things, like if you don't receive enough points, you know, for behavior, you may not be able to participate in a field trip, or you may not be able to attend the school social, or you may not have the privilege of eating lunch with your friends. So there are smaller consequences like that. And then there are, of course, detentions.
One of the things you bring up in the book is that the main purpose these schools say is that they want to get these students into college. And they've been fairly successful at that, haven't they? But have they taught these students how to succeed in college?
Yeah, I think one really interesting finding that these networks themselves are thinking about is, well, we've gotten all our kids or most of our kids to the college door, but actually lots of these kids aren't making it through college. So the KIPP network found that only about a third of their students are graduating from college within 6 years. And I think there are many reasons. There are multiple reasons why students may not be graduating from college, especially low-income students. Many of them have to work. It could have to do with academic preparation. But these schools really thought it had to do with these social and behavioral skills. So these schools are so strict. Are you really teaching students how to be independent in college, right? College, you just have a lot more freedom to do things. You don't have this rewards and consequences system. So are you teaching students, you know, how to advocate for themselves, how to speak up in class, how to go to a teacher's office hours? Are you even giving them the right impression of college? So one of my favorite quotes from the book is this eighth grader, and she went to visit a college and she saw couches in the dormitories. And she thought, well, maybe in college you can actually talk a little bit because there's couches there. So what do they expect? You're just gonna sit there and read a book? You must be able to talk a little bit. So she had gotten this impression from her own school that in college you couldn't talk at all, you know? So I think these networks are starting to think about how do we make this transition from a very structured environment to a much less structured environment in college.
It almost seems like they get to college and all of a sudden they're off script.
That's a great way to put it. And I think in my book, it's right. Instead of giving students scripts, can we give them tools that they can use and adapt in different kinds of situations?
Are there examples of schools around the country that are doing this right, that just have a great success track record?
I think there are schools that are starting to shift their practices, you know, individual schools within a network. For example, in the KIPP schools, I know the Bay Area KIPP schools have been looking at restorative justice disciplinary practices for a long time now. So I would say there are pockets of experimentation. And then, of course, there are charter schools that are very different from these schools, much more progressive schools that embrace project-based learning, you know, they're very race conscious. So there's a wide spectrum of charter schools. But among these kinds, I would say, surely you could find a few trying to do different things.
In the book, you go a bit into the history of the charter movement, and it was supposed to be something that spurred innovation and experimentation. That doesn't seem to be the way these schools are going.
Yes, the charter movement started with this idea that we're going to give teachers and schools more autonomy to be innovative. And no, I think what's happened is you had these first schools like the KIPP schools starting this model, and it was successful. So then you have these other charter founders, charter networks copying the successful model. So what you see is replication instead of innovation. You basically find a script that works and you stick with it. And we also have a lot of foundations kind of in the 90s, early 2000s, spreading the replication of this model because it seemed to be more effective than other models.
So if these schools were to evolve, and if they are evolving now, where is that originating? Is it the students, the teachers, the parents? Who's asking for change?
I think everybody is asking for change. I think we've seen protests by students. We've seen letters from teachers protesting these policies. And I think this is a moment for change. A lot of the networks this year have released public statements renouncing the no excuses philosophy, rethinking their disciplinary practices because of what people call the dual pandemics of systemic racism and COVID. So I think there certainly is a moment, and I think a lot of people are demanding change.
You bring up COVID, and of course, how do you do this model on a virtual basis?
Yeah, that I wish I had known. I didn't follow these schools into COVID. So I'm actually very curious what it looks like to do discipline on Zoom, or if these schools are finding an opportunity to do things differently, recognizing they can do their learning without these, you know, highly structured practices.
Again, the name of Dr. Joanne Golan's new book is Scripting the Moves, Culture and Control in a No Excuses Charter School. Still to come, we'll hear more from Education Secretary Miguel Cardona as he begins implementing the president's education agenda. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to the Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Last week, we heard from Secretary of Education Dr. Miguel Cardona as he spoke at the Education Writers Association's 74th Annual National Seminar. We thought this week we'd bring you some more of that conversation he had with moderator Sarah Carr, who is a member of the EWA board. She asked about a potential timetable to collaborate with states to fund universal pre-kindergarten.
You know, all you got to do is look at the data. We know a good foundation is pays dividends. You pay more in interventions for students if they're not prepared early on. So I think just being very clear about the benefits, you know. But I was in Illinois last month. I talked to J.B. Pritzker, the governor there, and he talked to me about the investment that they're making for early childhood education and pre-K in Illinois. And, you know, there is that sense that people understand the benefits of it. So yes, we're going to be working with those states on what this looks like. And again, learning from examples where it's working really well. But let's face it, this is a win for their state. This is a win for the education system. You know, pay now or pay later. I remember, I was a principal of a school with an early childhood program for 3 and 4 year olds with that needed a little bit of extra support. And I knew that intensive support at that age prevented them from needing additional reading tutoring, after school programming, summer school programming, which all costs money. Let's get it right in the beginning. Let's provide support. All the data shows that, you know, students with good early childhood programming do better. They get more access to honors level courses, which ultimately leads to life happiness. You know, when you graduate and you do well, you have options. It's either that or you pay for intervention throughout, which is more costly. So yes, we're going to be on the offense to make sure that people understand this is critically important. I mean, what an investment in our country to focus on early childhood education in addition to community college for all.
So there's been a lot of concern about inconsistency across the requirement to do standardized testing this spring. And I wondered if you could talk about the principles that are guiding the waiver decisions that you make. And I also, related to that, I hoped you could speak to, are you confident that the data that we'll get will justify the effort, given that there's a lot of students that are still studying remotely who aren't engaged in school right now, and that we can really get a true cross-section of students, including those who've been most underserved and disengaged throughout the pandemic?
You know, that the assessment question reminds me a lot of the reopening question from last July. You know, we were at a point where we were developing plans, every state was. We were developing plans based on the best science and the best information that we had on the pandemic. If you recall, we were looking at models of the flu to determine transmissibility of COVID-19. We didn't have any data on it, right? So we were developing plans, but then at some point in July last year, as Commissioner of Education, I had to make the decision. Are we going to reopen or are we not going to reopen? You just have to make the decision. Not easy, not popular with everyone, but you have to make a decision based on everything that you know. I make it analogous to that because it's unprecedented, right? The conditions are not perfect anywhere. I don't think there's a teacher across the country that needs a standardized test to tell them how the children in front of them are doing. Yet, we have to make a decision about how to move forward based on the data that we're receiving from states on the conditions of where they are, where their students are in terms of reopening. And we know that every little bit of data put together, because standardized testing aren't the end all, but putting those pieces of data together will help paint a picture that can help you distribute resources. Remember, we talked earlier about making sure that the resources are going to those kids that need it most. So for a teacher, they may not need that, but for a policymaker, for someone at the state level to say, this community needs to get more than this community based on what we're seeing, not only from the standardized test, but the opportunity to learn data as well and other measures, we're making very serious decisions about how to remove billions of dollars. So every little bit of data helps.
Well, thank you so much, Secretary Cardona. And I'm going to turn it over to Emily Richmond of the EWA staff for some audience questions.
So our first question comes from Chalkbeat's Kaylin Belshaw. She says, you highlighted the equity issue that students of color are less likely to be learning in person compared with white students right now. But some of that has to do with family choice, not what a school district is offering. Will you set a goal for the share of students you want to see actually learning in person in the fall? And would you advise school districts to offer a fully virtual option to parents or students who may want to take advantage of that?
So that's a great question. Thank you. I want all students to have the opportunity to learn in person in the spring, but I expect it in the fall. And with regard to the remote learning, if students select, you know, I do believe students learn best in the classroom. I'm not saying here that I think all students across the country should have an online learning opportunity. But I will say that we need to be innovative in how we connect with students. And we know that blended learning, you know, it didn't start with the pandemic. There are districts and states that really have taken advantage of the opportunity to provide blended learning for students to learn remotely or to learn from home or to have experiences where they're learning in a community of people from across the country. So blended learning should be a part of how we reimagine education. And learning doesn't always happen in the schoolhouse. I just left a automotive technology learning space where students spent 8 weeks in the field learning from folks in the field around automotive technology. And then they come back into the classroom and they'll tell you that that learning experience is so rich. As a matter of fact, it's leading to jobs for them. So we need to think outside of the box. We need to be creative around blended learning. But I need all students to have an opportunity to learn in the schoolhouse. What I don't want to see, to be very candid with you, is a system where students who were underserved in the past select remote learning because they don't feel that that school is welcoming or safe for them. We need to do better. We need to make sure all students prefer to learn in the schoolhouse because it's a warm place for them. It's a welcoming place. They see people that look like them, that honor them, that respect them. They see curriculum where they see their stories in the curriculum. All schools should be inviting places for not only students, but families. That's the goal. But yes, blended learning should be a part of the plan moving forward.
Linda Wertheimer, a freelance education journalist, asks, what role do you see the federal government, if any, playing in the ethnic studies movement in the nation's schools? Will it, for example, promote the 1619 Project in contrast to the prior administration's promotion of the debunked 1776 Commission report?
Yeah. So listen, I'm an educator at heart. I'm a teacher at heart. And while I know my role doesn't influence curriculum and nor do I believe the Secretary of Education or the Department of Education should be telling local districts what to teach in their courses, I do know that when students are seen in the curriculum, when they are felt like their stories are listened to or heard, they're more likely to engage and want to be there. You know, windows, mirrors, and sliding doors. And I'll just quickly just share what I mean by that. Curriculum should be a window into other cultures. It should be a mirror where you see yourself in it, and it should provide sliding glass doors where you could walk in for a little bit to see what other people experience. But I have complete confidence that our educators get it. Let our educators be a part of that process. They always keep the students at the center when making decisions. I think that's where the decisions need to be made, in the classroom by educators, our leaders in the schoolhouses who know what they're doing, and I have complete confidence that they're going to get it right. I don't think it's our role as a federal government to be dictating what's going to be taught in the curriculum, but it is our goal to make sure that all students have access to high quality curriculum and making sure that all students have access to opportunities and success after graduation.
That was Secretary of Education Dr. Miguel Cardona speaking at the Education Writers Association's 74th Annual National Seminar. He spoke with Sarah Carr, a longtime education reporter and a member of the EWA board. And again, thanks to the Education Writers Association for giving us access to this year's event. If space really is the final frontier, is it really wise for human beings to spend a lot of time up there? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Space holds the future for the human race. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Robert Edgell, professor of technology management at SUNY Polytechnic Institute, looks beyond our planet for innovation.
Should humans become space venturing, Certain scholars posit that it may be necessary for humans to venture out beyond Earth's orbit. Despite immense barriers, space affords opportunities for continued human evolution, economic vitality, Earth and life preservation, and technological innovation. Permanent expansion into the cold harshness of space could spur innovation in high-value sectors such as energy, transportation, and manufacturing while helping Earth. Over the last two millennia, density has increased from a comfortable 1 to over 50 humans per square kilometer. This, coupled with dirty technologies, has not only strained Earth's land area, but also stimulated climate change. However, relocating toxic manufacturing into space could mitigate these risks and thus make the planet more ecologically sustainable and livable. Imagine space service stations that would make mining feasible, lower the cost of exploration, and provide growth. An interplanetary economy with distant settlements might engender other benefits. Earth's geopolitical divisions may hinder experimentation with novel sociopolitical and economic arrangements, yet other world settlements could experiment and determine which forms of institutional organization work best given localized conditions. Settlers might tinker with alternative stakeholder firm models, distribution of wealth, and community contribution approaches. So the next time you gaze up into the expanse above, take a moment to contemplate how venturing out there just might make us better stewards down here.
That was Robert Edgell of SUNY Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.